Welcome to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. My name is Lauren Wells, here with my co-host, Chris Seveny. We're committed to providing you with the knowledge required to build wealth through real estate investing. Tired of consuming content about real estate? Stuck in analysis paralysis? Ready to do your first deal? As a member of our community, you will learn how to go from consuming content to taking that first step into the world of real estate investing. Our show is not about getting rich quick, but about providing you with the knowledge you need to take action. Join us as we speak with experienced investors who share action tips on how to escape the corporate world, start a thriving side hustle in the world of real estate, and go beyond your W-2 or 401k.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. I am your host, Chris Seveny. Today, I have a special guest. I have David Chudik. David is a certified financial planner as well as a certified value builder. And we will talk a little bit about that. And basically, since 2005, David has been advising clients on how to make the right financial decisions for them and for reasons that are important to them. So, David, how are you this Friday?
Hey, I am doing really, really well. This has been a fun year in the financial planning business. Lots of ups and downs in the markets, which creates really the need for really good, strong, sound, logical advice. So yeah, I'm excited to be here and talk wealth building.
So I'm going to actually put you on the spot right now on a quick question is, what's the worst advice you've heard somebody give somebody else in this market, just out of curiosity, if you have one?
Well, yeah, I mean, people will say illogical things like, I'm going to lose all of my money, which if you lose all of your money, then we're back in prehistoric times and Russians have invaded and it's Red Dawn. So when people start talking about, I don't believe in the stock market no more and things like that, we never bet against the American economy over the long term. Now, are we going to have years where the markets are down? Absolutely. What people don't understand is, yeah, most people lost between 10 and 20% of their portfolios last year. And I did, and it stinks. I don't like losing money, right? But if you've been investing for a long time, what you lost is just a part of the money that you've gained. So when you're having years and years and years in gain, and then you have a bad year, yeah, you've given back some of the house's money. But yeah, there's always a bright future.
Yeah, I was at a conference this past week and markets came up and stuff and somebody brought up a good point. And their comment was, how many have ever lost all their money they invested in individual stock? And, you know, 3/4 of the room raised their hand, and I did because WorldCom was one. And then you ask the next question, how many of you have ever lost all your money in an index fund or like a Fidelity mutual fund or something like that? And of course, nobody raises their hand. And they basically right there. Yeah. Diversity. Like you mentioned, the entire stock market went to zero. Then we have bigger problems. So,
yeah. Then you need to be, I guess, invested in lead. And that's why, like you said, you shouldn't own just one stock. You shouldn't even own one asset class. I mean, real estate is a very important asset class that many people should own. Yes. Even precious metals, there are some times where permanent life insurance, there's all kinds of different ways to diversify your risk. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so, and that's how we mitigate things. So that's when people start really talking negatively about the markets. And of course, it depends on your time horizon. There are a lot of different factors, but if you have years and years and years to invest, getting out of the market is typically not a great idea if you're getting out all the way.
Sometimes my coworkers call me the squirrel who's always chasing shiny objects. So sorry, I threw that curveball at you to start. Let's rewind a little bit for our listeners. And can you kind of explain to us what a certified financial planner is for those that don't know? That'd be a great place to start.
Yeah, well, it starts with some pretty difficult exams and studying and certification. And it's actually gotten harder since I got the exams. The CFP board certifies CFP certificates. And we have a very high fiduciary responsibility to where we have to give no consideration to our benefit. The client's best interest has to be considered. And that even comes down to if there's an area of financial planning where I don't have the expertise, I would need to tell you, you know what, Chris, I can't help you here. This is not my area. I'm going to have to refer this out. So we have a very high level of responsibility to our clients. And what we do is we follow a process to where we are actually planning. So we're analyzing, we're recommending needs, we're monitoring solutions and things like that. And that helps our clients to have a holistically strong financial life. So let's say that someone who's not a certified financial planner and someone who's not working with a comprehensive planning process, let's say they work with your investment portfolio and you build up a portfolio of millions of dollars. They did a good job managing your money. But let's say they never talk to you about your wills, and they never talk to you maybe about life insurance, and they never talk to you about even your property and casualty insurance. So now you run a stop sign and you rear end someone who has five people in their car and they're all severely injured. Now there's several million dollars of lawsuits. Well, guess what? Your investment account may be gone because they did not look at your insurances. So that's just kind of one example of where holistically financial planning, there's so much more to it than just where's the best place to make the most money on my money right now.
Okay. Yeah, that's a very good definition. I think that last part is what a lot of people forget is, you know, it's, you know, not only asset kind of acquisition valuation, but the asset protection side of things. And one of the things that I see a lot of people look at, especially in the real estate side, is, for example, you mentioned life insurance. And life insurance is just that, it's an insurance policy. And some people like to use, you know, cash value as some type of investment vehicles. And then they'll basically knock it because, oh, well, I can do better returns than like what I could get on that as investment vehicle. And people when I talked to, I said, well, it's not an investment vehicle. It's a piece of the component or the pie that it's insurance as well. So if I drop dead tomorrow, you know, hey, look, there's X millions of dollars that, depending on your policy size, there's this much money that would go to the family as part of that asset protection. You know, there's always an offense and defense is the way I like to look at financial planning.
Yep. No question. So I lost my sister a few months ago. And,
oh, I'm sorry.
And she's 51, has a 19-year-old son. Mm-hmm. And that little life insurance, now this was turned out to be a term policy, but that little policy that cost her $45 a month or whatever it was, that is literally the difference between him being able to mourn in peace and not worry about money, or mourning and also having to worry about how do I pay my bills, or having to move in with me and I pay his bills. So that's one small component of the financial planning process. But if we're going to be holistic, we have to look at everything. And the idea is that client can sleep at night when they know that every part of my financial life is okay, or if it's not okay, we have a plan to make it okay. How many families are out there with children and they don't have a guardian picked out so that both parents get into a car accident and now relatives may be fighting over the kids? So having those conversations on, you know, who do we want to get the kids if something happened? Those are tough things to talk about. They actually cost a little bit of money as well to go to an attorney, get the documents drawn up, but it's just part of being a grown-up and part of being financially sound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things I'll mention is, like, my wife and I, when we put together our estate planning and, you know, created a trust and stuff, we kind of put it off and share this with people of the reason I put it off is I thought kind of I was going to jinx myself that, oh, if I put a will together, then I'm going to die. Kind of one of those things that nobody likes to think about it. But unfortunately, reality is nobody gets out of here alive at the end of the day. Yeah. So it's something that I strongly recommend you plan ahead of time. Case in point, I have a family member who had a sister-in-law who recently passed, and it was unexpected. They're approximately about 60 years old, and the person didn't have any family or any children or a significant other, but basically hadn't done any planning and had a house, had a lot of cash, had a lot of different things. And now, because there was no planning in place, it's just been a lot of chaos. And the chaos for the people who now are having to go through and resolve it. And of course, anytime, a lot of times there could be potentially some financial incentives involved and it's not clear who's getting what. Of course, that just adds some conflict as well. So,
and money makes normal people go crazy as well. So if there's an inheritance and things are not clearly spelled out how things should be divvied up, there could be bad feelings. There are times when parents say, for whatever reason, I'm not going to leave equal amounts to all my siblings, to all my children. And if it's written out and if there's reasons, then people can accept it. But if there's money involved, people go crazy. So get your stuff in order, deal with the questions and problems that we don't want to deal with, but deal with it once. Then you look back every few years and it's done.
I do want to shift a little bit in a minute to the other aspect of how you help business owners as well. But before we hit top off of that, if you can give people some advice as a planner, again, not giving financial advice, you know, to somebody specifically, because I know there's a lot of caveats that what has to happen, but just holistically in general, from planning perspectives and things, you know, what are best recommendations that somebody should probably try and follow?
Yeah. So I can spend a minute and we can talk about the basics of financial planning. And this applies to you. It applies to me. It applies to LeBron James. It applies to somebody who makes minimum wage. It applies to all of us. So B, budget. You got to get your budget under control. I don't know how much money you make, but you need to spend a little bit less than what you make. And the more money you make, the more margin there is. If you're making minimum wage, there's not a lot of margin. So have some sort of a spending plan for your budget. A, for basics, it's allocation. Figure out where your money should go. Like you said before, there were people at your conference that lost all of their money that was in one stock. Nobody lost all of their money when it was diversified. So how much money should you have in real estate? I own real estate. How much money should you have in stocks and bonds and precious metals and crypto, things like that? And then that's different for everybody. You can work on that yourself or you can work with a financial advisor. Then S is systems. You got to have financial systems in place. That's everything from monthly investments. It's everything from periodically meeting with your advisors. It's everything. Maybe you and your spouse have a monthly meeting and discuss where how you're doing financially. I, in basics, is insurance. So what we just talked about before is insurance basically protects your money. I mean, I don't want insurance. I don't care about insurance. But I want to know that if I rear-end your car and you're severely injured, number one, I mean, I'm a nice person. I'd want you to get good medical care. But number two, I don't want to pay for it. I'd rather my insurance company pay for it. So my insurance is hopefully adequate to cover just about anything that can happen. And there's lots of different types of insurances. And if you're a business owner, you really need a good local insurance agent. C for basics is caring. How are you going to use your money to care for the world? When you're 80 years old and maybe on your deathbed, you're not going to say, you know what? I had a Mercedes, and if I had the nicer Mercedes, just one more model up, my life would have been better. You're probably going to look back and say, you know what? I think there were some people I should have helped more, and maybe there was an organization I should have given more money to. So how are you using your money to care for the world? And part of that might be, you know what? I need to make less money, take a different job so I'm working less and I can see my family because that's caring for the world. So making those financial decisions. And finally, the S for basics is support. We all need support people, whether that's accountability partners, spouses, attorneys. Googling how to write a contract is probably not a good idea. Real estate professionals, financial advisors, accountants, we need support to help us with what we don't know. And so if we all follow the basics, budget, allocation, systems, insurance, caring, and support, you're going to be kind of okay. There's not a whole lot that you could screw up if you're working all those in the right direction.
That's awesome advice. A few things that kind of resonate with me during that is, you know, on the budget and allocation, you know, allocation is kind of diversifying your portfolio, but also allocation of when you budget, how much can you allocate? And one of the things that we do is, you know, we have basically money automatically withdrawn from our account every time we have a paycheck. So it's like we never see it because like anything, if it's there, you know, you'll spend it somewhere else. So we have so much taken out that goes towards basically we break everything down into little components. And this conference I was at this past week is a group I'm part of called GoBundance. And what they have, you know, as part of this group, they do what's called a one sheet, which is like a baseball card of your life for every year. And they basically have you go through and there's the financial side of, okay, how much did you make this past year in vertical income, which is your W-2 income, and your horizontal income, which is your passive income, stocks, real estate. And okay, is that growing? What was it last year? What was it this year? How much you pay in taxes? What are your expenses? And then outlining like, okay, like why do you have so much in expenses? And then another component is like your net worth on, you know, is that increasing or decreasing? And then others are like your goals for the year. And it talks about things on there like your insurance and your giving. How much did you give this past year in money and time? And then others, it's almost exactly what you said, the basics, because it has support on there. What's your biggest needs for you this year? Or who's a part of that team? So it's very similar to what I just went through. And the interesting thing is when you put everything down on paper like that and it basically ends up being a goal, then you have something to go against. And it's not just you're going through life wondering where things are at. You're actually basically creating that picture every year, every quarter, whatever it is, to understand, because also things change in life and things can change very quickly in life. And you want to also be able to adapt quickly. And the only way to adapt is to have that information readily available and handy. So
you got to be purposeful in all areas of life that are important. So marriage is hard. I mean, could you imagine living with me? I mean, that would be difficult, but you have to be purposeful in having a good marriage and in health. Nobody ever ate one cheeseburger and gained 100 pounds. You gain 100 pounds by a few extra calories per day over years and decades, and then you're bigger than you want to be. And same thing in money. It's not that easy to destroy your financial life with one decision. So being purposeful, which is exactly what you just described, is how we can succeed in the areas of life that are important to us. So it's simple. It's not easy, but it's simple, or it's not always easy.
Yeah. I've learned nothing is easy in life, unfortunately. I don't think everything takes to get to where you want to attain your goals. It's hard work and effort. And if it's easy for you to obtain that goal, then you set the wrong goal. That's just my personal. So let's roll a little bit. So we talked somewhat on the financial planning side. I hope people gain some value from that. Let's talk about kind of the next aspect of what I think really differentiates yourself from a lot of other financial planners and stuff that I talked about. Let's talk a little bit about the business side, because a lot of our listeners are entrepreneurs or run businesses, and we're really talking about creating, you know, ways that you can create wealth. And a lot of people do that through entrepreneurship. So can you tell me a little bit about that aspect?
Yeah. So if you look at the biggest asset of most business owners is the business itself. And it's also an asset that you have a lot of direct control over. A lot of times I'll talk to business owners and number one, they'll be saying, well, should I buy Amazon or sell Amazon? Or what about Apple and these things? Well, I mean, our firm, we have a process to make those decisions, but ultimately we don't have any direct control over what Apple or Amazon or Google does. Mm-hmm. So we can follow a process and our process is good, but of course it's not always right. But in your own business, you have a lot of direct control over what you can do to help to build the value of the business. There are 8 drivers of business value that if you get those right, your business is going to be much, much, much more attractive to a potential buyer. So then you can sell the business for more or higher multiple when you're ready. Or you just have an easier and more profitable life today because a sellable business is a more profitable business. So as an example, one of the 8 value drivers is what we call the hub and spoke. And you've probably seen something like this, and this may apply in your business, and it certainly has applied in my business. When the business owner is kind of the hub of everything and doing almost everything and has their hand in almost everything and can't take time off because they have their hand in almost everything, would you buy that business or would you buy it for a premium price? I don't think so. I always use the example. Let's say you got out of your business and you're someone who likes doing lawn care. So if Chris starts Chris's lawn care business, he buys a riding mower and he just goes around, knocks on doors and says, hey, you know, I'd cut somebody else's grass in your neighborhood. I'd like to cut your grass. Here's a price. And then they say, yes, that's fine. So now Chris is just Chris. It's Chris and a truck and a lawnmower. And he builds up a list of people whose grass he cuts, but he doesn't have contracts. He doesn't have any other employees. And then Chris gets to the point where he's ready to retire. And Chris comes to me and says, hey, David, would you like to buy my lawn care business? I brought in X amount of dollars last year. I do my due diligence. And I said, well, first of all, when you leave, most people are using Chris for Chris because they like Chris. So when Chris is gone, they may not stay with me. Number two, you don't have signed contracts. You don't have policies and procedures in place. So really, the only thing I would buy from you is your lawnmower. Whereas if you built up a whole system where you have a team and processes and standards and build up a brand and you have maybe some additional services that make your company different, then all of a sudden I'm thinking, you know what? I'm going to buy that business and I may pay a higher multiple for it because number one, I'm not going to have to be the one cutting grass. And if I have a bad day or I'm sick and I can't cut grass, there's no money being made. And number two, it's kind of running, I won't say on cruise control, but it's running without the direct daily total overseeing of the business owner. So that's just one of them. But I know that a lot of business owners struggle with being way too involved with way too many aspects of their businesses.
It's really interesting because 2 things came to light. Literally before this recording, I was on a call with my senior leadership team, and that was pretty much the exact conversation of, okay, I run off on an island. You guys don't hear from me again. Kind of, here's the vision of the company. Here's how things implementing that process for, you know, having the business continue on from that standpoint and making sure the people are in the right seats on the bus. And of course, having that expertise and getting them ready to get to that standpoint, hypothetically. And that's what we were literally just doing earlier today. The second component that you hit the nail on the head was, in the past, I've looked at buying some construction companies. And construction companies are a perfect example of the owner goes and gets these contracts, or they may have an agreement that they're building Honda dealerships for this one person in a region, but there's no other signed agreements. And that person is literally the lifeblood. And that's all there is to the company. And there's no systems, there's no processes, no procedures, there's no really, it's not a well-organized or run business. And they want this extreme multiple based off of, oh, well, we have $1 million in contracts, so we think it's worth $5 million. And it's like, well, when you're gone, there's just that $1 million in contracts that really you're just buying those projects. There's nothing else to that business. So to me, I looked at it at a much lower value because of that. Because also for me, if I were to just go start this business by myself, could I do it for less money and still I wouldn't have those contracts, but should I pay an extra millions of dollars for something that doesn't exist? So that's kind of a perfect example when people look at companies to really understand what the company is going to look like after that acquisition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no question whatsoever. Some other things to look at is what we call the Switzerland structure. So how dependent is a business on any one thing? Let's say you have that construction company and you have one sales rep that's going out and getting 95% of your jobs. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to buy your company from you because that sales rep, as soon as they leave, there goes 95% of the revenue. So in theory, you would have several sales reps who are getting jobs. Let's say that you are overly building Honda dealerships, right? Well, what happens when Honda goes out of business or somebody else gets into the Honda group? Mm-hmm. If you're selling on only one digital platform, digital platforms change. So we want diversification and not to be overly dependent on one employee, on one vendor, on one supplier, on one industry, or even on one customer. I mean, there are businesses that may have one or two huge customers, and that's great until they leave. Mm-hmm. And I would definitely use that as a negotiating tool. If I were buying your company and you had two or three large customers, and if one of them left, it would have a severe impact on cash flow, I would argue that your company is worth less, even if those are great customers, because that's a huge risk that I'm taking by buying your company and the revenue is not diversified.
Yeah. More great points right there. And every business owner really needs to think about is, like you said, how dependent. Now, you as the business owner, and typically if you're small and entrepreneur and you're just starting that business, yes, of course, you're the most important person. And something happens to you, it's going to be difficult for others to step in. But as you look to exit that business, what is it that makes it the most valuable? Is can somebody step in? And is there a wealth of people who will stay and have that structure in place? So it's not all relying, like you said, on one salesperson or one person. And who knows the secret sauce? We use Kentucky Fried Chicken. Well, if Colonel Sanders basically was the only one who knew the recipe and he left it, went away, and the recipe was locked in a safe no one could get to, then there it goes. So,
yeah. Well, and how many small businesses does literally the owner have a list of passwords to important sites and nobody knows where that password is? And if that owner, I mean, COVID happens, people end up on ventilators, people get in car accidents. So that's really, really important to get the owner out of it. And you can do that with standard operating procedures and things like that and clarifying everybody's jobs and roles and responsibilities. But when it comes down to it, a lot of business owners, we have this innate desire to be really freaking important. And we want to say that we're busy, but ultimately our goal should be not to be busy. Our goal to be to where we're not doing anything other than the few things that only we can do to really move the needle on the business. And a lot of that normally does not include clerical work. It doesn't include scrubbing toilets. Not that we're too good to do that, but we got to do the things that only we can do and delegate the rest.
What are a few other things for business valuation that either things you see people miss the boat on or things that could add significant value to a company?
Yeah. So if you were looking to buy a business, you're going to sign some sort of a confidentiality agreement and then a letter of intent that's going to kind of at least outline the general terms of purchase. Then there's going to be a due diligence period where you and your attorneys and your representation can look through the books and see what you're actually buying. Mm-hmm. And if the books are not reliable or defendable, of course, that means the company is worth less. So strongly, and if you're a big enough business to have professionally audited books every year, makes your financials more reliable, and that gives you a potentially higher multiple. Going back to the construction, it's interesting that you say that because construction companies, they tend to start off as dude that likes building stuff. So the dude gets involved with building and then they do a good job and then the business grows, They're doing their books out of their truck and then the business grows and they're typically horrible at running businesses, good at building stuff. And then it comes to tax time. They have no idea how much money they made. Their expenses are not recorded accurately. So number one, it's a mess to run a business like that. And number two, you wouldn't want to buy a business whose books are a mess. So financial record keeping and financial performance are hugely, hugely important as well.
So one thing that I think a lot of people listening can relate to, and I think fall into this trap a little bit, is if you're buying a rental property or portfolio from another investor, that's the equivalent of buying a business, just like you said. I can't tell you how many times I've looked at a portfolio. It might have been 10 houses, six single families, four duplexes. So let's say it's 15, 16 units or wherever it may be. And then I'd say, okay, provide me the financials on it. And they basically send me a spreadsheet that just has some numbers on it. And of course, it's like, well, they're getting 600 for rent, but it could be 800. And I'm like, okay, do you have like NOI? How much? Oh, these are just estimates. And I'm like, well, what are the last 3 years' financials so I can see how these are running? Are they profitable? Or are they not profitable? And they're like, well, they don't have that information. And I'm like, well, I'm taking this information then for a grain of salt that you're telling me, because if you don't have that information, you're just garbage in, garbage out. This number, I mean, you can write any number on this piece of paper, great, but you have no financials to back this. And then when you try and negotiate with them lately, they're like, well, we'll just find somebody who will buy it off of this information. And to me, it's like, great, go ahead, find somebody. But right. I want to know the true numbers, because I don't want to go pay based off these numbers and have it be something different. Or God forbid, I mentioned to them, I say, okay, if I go off these numbers, but these numbers are double, I want money held in escrow that then you'll reimburse me for this. And then they all look at me like I have seven heads and laugh at me. That's one thing just for everyone listening. That's so important that I've worked for a company that used to work for a large company that actually bought several companies. And I was on the M&A team doing this due diligence. And one thing I will always tell everybody, when you start diving into books or a company that doesn't have books or they're very inaccurate, you are peeling like the first layer of about a 15 layered onion of they're not going to tell you, or they may say there's one little thing wrong, but that is like the most minor of things. And there's a lot more going on behind the scenes. It never gets better. Let me just state that in 25 years, I've never seen anything get better on a financials when I started due diligence. I've always seen worse. And actually, David, I'd love to ask that question to you. Am I just an oddity that I'm the only one that's ever seen that, or based off of what you've seen? I'd love to get your opinion.
Wow. So I have a client who I've been working with, and nice person. She sent me an email saying, I'm making progress. I'm now paying sales tax. I'm now paying income tax. I'm now paying payroll taxes. So nice person, really didn't know how to run a business. And it was totally just not run correctly, as far as literally could have probably ended up in jail. She turned things around. It's a good thing. But yeah, it's unfortunately, it's sloppiness. And I mean, my business is, there are times that I can be sloppy as well, but you got to have stuff under control. You see it a lot with new businesses. They get $100 of revenue and they say, hey, I have $100 to spend. Well, no, you don't, because some of that needs to be put away for taxes. If it's profit, some of it needs to be put away to buy inventory. Some of it needs to be put away to pay your people. So I've seen some doozies for sure.
Yeah, I remember just one where, again, it was a construction company we were looking at. And then we started digging into some of the contracts that they said they had, and they actually weren't contracts. They were just estimates that they had put out, and then started looking at the financials on the projects, and they were not forecasting future losses based off of the losses they already had. For example, they had staff on the project, but they were over budget on staff, but they weren't forecasting the staff for the next 4 months to finish the project. So, you know, all of a sudden it's like numbers looked a lot worse as you got into it.
Business ultimately is a math equation. It just is. You can be a nice person, but if you're spending more than what's coming in for revenue, nice person or not, your business doesn't survive that indefinitely.
Yep. So what's one more thing, piece of advice on the business side for people either looking to acquire another entity or people looking to exit? Of course, keeping your numbers in-house. And I know a lot of people like to do things off the book for tax purposes and so forth, which, hey, that may benefit you there. But if you're ever looking to exit that thing, it's going to hurt you at some point. So there's probably some balance, but what are some of the other things?
I had lunch with my accountant last year, and he said, there's a restaurant in town that you would know because you probably drive by it every day. And I forget the numbers, but he said they reported like $100,000 in revenue and a loss. And of course, they probably bring in that in every 2 weeks or every week. Yeah. And they tried to borrow money by another restaurant. And obviously, they couldn't get it because their revenue wouldn't support that. And then they wanted my accountant to write some letters saying revenue is, he's like, I can't do that. I mean, the revenue that what you told me you make, I mean, I can't necessarily say that it's not, I mean, I'm going by your numbers and filing your tax return based on it. But it was probably pretty clear that they were reporting almost nothing. So it does bite you. Inaccurate books on the low end helps you with taxes, even though it's immoral and illegal on the front end, but it does make it much harder to sell a business for the right amount. And it makes it harder to borrow money. So if you need to borrow money and the numbers are not accurate, you're definitely not going to be looking good. Yeah. So you want to do that. And then something else for business owners, if you can figure out a way to generate recurring subscription-based revenue, you're much more likely to get a higher or multiple. And there are some florists that came out with the idea of, we make a lot of money during Mother's Day and Valentine's Day, but then the rest of the year, it's not that much. So there was a florist that said, I'm going to go to higher end restaurants and I'm going to go to higher end hotels and say, I'm going to charge you X amount of money per month, whatever that amount was. And then I'm going to come to your restaurant and your floor and I'm going to take care of your plants. I'm going to rotate them out, put seasonal plants in. And that gave them a predictable revenue stream. And that gives you a much higher selling price of a business. So,
well, you look at anything nowadays, especially software and everything, it has all gone from the one-off acquisition to the monthly. I know QuickBooks, for example, I used to use QuickBooks, or still do, and that just switched from, hey, you got to go to a monthly subscription service. Everything streaming now is pretty much on monthly services. I almost don't know anything. And even I think like Tesla or some companies now are even offering monthly subscription services for things. Everything is going to that model. And there's a reason why. And just as you mentioned, because it makes them more valuable or profitable. Even fitness equipment, has subscription agreements now for being on their exercise programs. We use, I forget which type of fitness equipment we use, but they have things that you can sign up to get you because that's where the money is, that recurring revenue and income.
Yeah, no question. And if you looked at your own credit card statement, everybody probably has Netflix and Hulu. And once you get signed up, you forget about it. And so subscriptions, definitely a big thing.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, as we wrap up this episode, David, two things. One is, people are looking for your services. Where can they reach you? Email, website? How can people reach out to you? And then the last piece is, too, is if there's any last thoughts that you want to share with people.
Yeah. So check out my podcast. It's the Weekly Wealth Podcast. We talk about the mindsets, the tactics, and the strategies that can help you to build and maintain wealth. So you can find that on Apple, Spotify, or just go to www.weeklywealthpodcast.com. I think we're at episode 114. So we've put out quite a few episodes, and I like to talk about the non-tangible parts of money. So we don't typically talk about where the markets are going. We talk to business coaches on how to run a more profitable business. We talk to attorneys on which business documents you should have and things like that. So weeklywealthpodcast.com. If you're interested in kind of the other part of my financial planning practice, the business valuation coaching, you can go to my website, www.allofmyassets.com. And you can actually take the value builder score. It'll give you a range of value for your business based on the numbers you put in. And it also will tell you some of the areas that your business may need to improve to help the valuation. And kind of the premise of the name of the website is, most business owners, they neglect the value of their biggest asset. So I want to help you with all of your assets, not just your IRA accounts, not just your Roth IRA. I want to help you with your business. A lot of business owners say, well, I don't really need to save that much money because I'm going to sell my business. Okay, well, how much are you going to sell it for? I don't know, $20 million. Okay, well, where'd you come up with that number? I don't know. I just think that's what it's worth. Okay, well, it may or may not be what it's worth, but what if you could make a few changes over the last 5 years of your career and get 25 million or 30? Or what if 20 is not even close to the real number? And now the fact is you might be able to get a million for it. Well, then we need to plan with that reality. So the value builder score can be taken at allofmyassets.com. It takes you 10, 15 minutes at the most, and it gives you some really, really valuable insight on your business. And then if there's anything just keeping you up at night about money in general, I'm always happy to do a 30-minute call with anybody. So David at parallelfinancial.com, or you can go to my Calendly link, which is www.calendly.com/DavidPF. And the PF is for Parallel Financial.
Cool. Before we finish, a question did pop in my head that I'll just figure while I have you on this podcast, ask you, because I think a lot of people see this, run into this, and I'm curious how it's typically handled. You're looking at a business to acquire, and let's say it had revenues of $900,000, $1 million, and all of a sudden it jumped to like 1.7 the third year. And of course, now they're trying to sell it based off of that 1.7 valuation. And it may have been caused, it's not really clear. I know in real estate, like COVID on short-term rentals had a huge boom, which increased a lot, and people were buying off that highest number and so forth. I'm just curious, as somebody who values businesses, when you see something like that, how does somebody evaluate that? Because sometimes you may have a seller that has very high demand based off of that latest, but you as a buyer also realize, hey, is it fool's gold, essentially, if I tried to pay for that valuation?
Yeah. And that's the question, right? So the seller wants to get the highest price. The borrower wants to pay the lowest reasonable price. Mm-hmm. So did it jump up by 40 or 50%? And is that a trend that's likely to continue? And if so, then that's a negotiating tool for a higher multiple. If there was one contract that was a one-off type deal or a construction company that just had that one contract that's not recurring, or if there's a project with the government that's a one-time deal. Because what are you buying with the business? You're buying the assets. So you're buying the desks, the trucks, the equipment, but you're really also buying what you think the future revenue stream is. So if the future revenue stream is likely to be that higher number, then yeah, you pay for it. If the future revenue stream is not likely to be that higher number because that was an anomaly, then that's a bargaining tool that both sides are going to have to hash out for sure.
Cool. Interesting. So, well, David, thank you for coming on the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. As people, David mentioned, go on to his podcast, weeklywealthpodcast.com, his website, allmyassets.com, schedule a call with him, calendly.com/DavidPF, if I got that correct as well. So
you got it. Yeah,
and
absolutely.
We will have all this in the show notes. David, thank you for joining us. And as always, people, make sure to listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite listening station. Thank you all.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining Lauren and I on this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. Each week, we bring you expert education, experience, and information in a digestible format to help you identify investment opportunities so you can build wealth through real estate and take action toward your financial goals. Enjoy the show, share with a friend, or subscribe to the show and leave us a review.